This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Good morning, friends.
Good morning, Marvin. Can
In
you hear me?
In the untouched regions
yes,
of the forest,
I can hear you.
The kōkako runs through the treetops feeding on leaves, flowers and fruit. The South Island kōkako, with its distinctive orange wattles at the base of the bill, hasn't been sighted in many years and may be extinct. A situation the blue-wattled bird of the North Island may find itself in unless its habitat is preserved. Its delightful call includes a variety of rich organ and bell-like notes.
Community or chaos, we can construct and nurture community or fall into chaos. Over the next hour, Marvin Hubbard hosts conversations toward creating a fairer, more equal society.
Community or Chaos is made possible with the support of Quakers Aotearoa. You'll find them online at quaker.org.nz.
Good morning, friends. Today we have Craig Rennie, the economist and director of policy at New Zealand Council of Trade Unions. And you can podcast this by going to oarfmradio.org.nz and then going to podcast and going to Community or Chaos. Well, welcome to Community or Chaos, Craig.
Thank you for having me on, Marvin.
So why did you become the CTU economist and policy advisors, and what do you expect to be doing by the December 2026?
I became CTU economist because I'm a big believer in the value of trade unions. I'm a big believer in the ability of trade unions to make enormous differences to people's lives. I'm the son of a coal miner from the northeast of England, who saw it firsthand, the value of trade unions when I was young, during the miners' strike in the UK.
Yeah, I remember that quite well, yeah. Even though I wasn't there.
I was very much there. I was quite small at the time, but I remember it vividly. The value, the solidarity, the social justice, the things that we know that are really important in New Zealand, trade unions are at the heart of helping to deliver. And we know we have lots of problems in the labour market in New Zealand. We have too much exploitation of workers. Too many workers are underpaid. We know that we have an economy that isn't delivering for working people. And it's partly my job to help, one, find out what's really going on, two, tell people about it, and then three, help design solutions that will help tackle those problems. So I'm very lucky. I've got one of the best jobs in the world, Marvin. And I'm very lucky to have it. What I'll be doing between now and December is essentially the same thing. I'll be pointing out the key issues that the government's getting wrong. I'll be campaigning on making those better, and we'll be working on trying to deliver a better government in 2026 so that we can do the things we all know that are essential. Things like bringing back fair pay agreements, things like delivering pay equity for female-dominated workforces, and importantly, making sure that we're spending the right amount of money on public services in New Zealand so we can have the health systems, the education systems, and the public housing that we all know we need.
The two things that the Labour Party have come forward recently are the capital gains tax, a very mild, narrow capital gains tax, and a promise to introduce a futures fund. And what is the futures fund and what does that mean?
So the future fund is a policy designed to create deeper pools of capital in New Zealand for investment. New Zealand's a country that really suffers from a lack of investment. We have approximately $106 billion infrastructure gap right now. That's public investment in things like schools, hospitals, roads, stuff that should exist and doesn't. And we don't have the investment pools to help deliver it. We also know that small businesses, when they're developing in New Zealand and turning into larger businesses, they really struggle to attract capital, which is why they end up in places like Australia on the ASX. A big part of the Future Investment Fund's role is to essentially to start the program of investing in ourselves, to help create the deeper pools of capital so that we can be building a broader, more resilient economy in New Zealand, but also to help grow our national assets and our national wealth. If we look at the example of Singapore, for example, Temasek, that started out with a relatively small investment. It's now worth half $1 trillion New Zealand dollars. If we look at the investments through the Norwegian State Pension Fund, established to deal with the proceeds of New Zealand, Norwegian oil from the North Sea, every single Norwegian is worth just shy of $1 million New Zealand dollars inside that fund. So there's a lot to like. We don't have that here. We might have had it if we didn't have dancing Cossacks at a particular election.
Labour Party under Norman Kirk was
more investment, so we can invest in ourselves.
The Labour Party under Norman Kirk, people were my age may remember, was going to introduce, in fact, did introduce this, a fund like this, and Muldoon scrapped it. So, you don't think that private public partnerships are the way forward?
Sorry, Marvin, I didn't hear any of that. You stopped speaking. Your web link broke down.
Do you think that the National Party's idea of public-private partnerships is the way forward? I know some people in the Labour Party have agreed with that.
No. Public-private partnerships are often just ways to help manage spending that we should be doing anyway, and doing it in much more expensive ways. I happen to live in here in Whanganui Itara in Wellington, and we're resurfacing Transmission Gully a few years after having opened it. A road that was supposed to cost $300 million ended up costing more than $1 billion, has been delivered by a private sector actor who walked away from the project, and now the road is not fit for purpose. There are plenty of ways in which we can be delivering projects, including public-public partnerships, where we work with iwi, where we work with KiwiSaver funds, we work with a range of other actors, but there's not huge need in New Zealand for public-private partnerships because they're just more expensive ways of delivering things that we can deliver via the state.
Also, there's a question about whether you still have public control.
Well, absolutely. And importantly, so in the UK, where we've tried PPPs and what are called PFIs or private finance initiative programs, that loss of control has become incredibly expensive to get back. And it leads to very poor outcomes. So we should own public assets for the public good, for the public benefit, because they're delivering public services. The imposition of the private sector is just adding a layer of profit for a private sector actor that doesn't meet any of those goals.
Would you recommend coming back with something like the Department of Public Works? We had a Department of Public Works until Labor under Roger Douglas got rid of it. And it did two things. It planned for the future, and it planned for things like we had a Department of Public Works, we wouldn't be running on electricity at critical periods.
I think it's essential that we have the means to deliver public projects as the government, as the country, that we're not reliant entirely on private sector providers to do that. And that's for really good reasons. If not least, it's actually for really good competition reasons. It helps to reduce costs. But you're right, Marvin. I actually think the Ministry of Works did three things. It planned works much better so that you could deliver more works more efficiently. Two, it delivered a lot of the trades training around the country. So many of the plumbers, the plasterers, the electricians, everybody else were actually trained through the Ministry of Works, and that helps build the pipeline of those trades in the rest of the country. But three, one of the things the Ministry of Works did was it built to need, not to profit. So we ended up with schools that actually worked, that were good schools. We ended up with hospitals that had the number of beds in that we wanted to build, rather than things that were profitable for the builder at the time. And so in doing those three things, we end up with much better outcomes. So I would strongly support bringing back the ability to for the Crown to build these sorts of things, if for no other reason than it helps reduce the cost of those of the delivery of those programs.
Speaking of competition, they also gave the government a source of financial information apart from Treasury, as well as Treasury.
Well, one of the things it did much better was it gave us the ability to actually work out true cost-benefit analysis. Because right now, we know the cost of building schools and hospitals and roads and other things, but we don't know the cost of not building those things.
But you don't find that out until after you
leave. No, absolutely. And those things are measured in the cost. You know, if you don't build a hospital, you don't bear the cost of building the hospital, but then people don't have the health services that they need. And they're the ones bearing the cost from the lack of that information. And so it starts to provide that information much better and in ways that, again, help people understand and help decision makers understand whether or not things should happen.
Recently, we've seen more workers, public workers mainly, going on strike in the last 2 weeks than we've seen in the last 20 years. Not just health workers, but teachers, firefighters, and other public servants. Could you talk about this?
Of course. I think one of the things that we've seen from this government is that it's been very consistently keen to help fund its fiscal plan by reducing the wages of workers in essential public services and more widely through real terms pay cuts. So we've seen over the past 2 years, the minimum wage has gone up by less than inflation every year. Your average full-time minimum wage worker is now $1,300 worse off than they were at the election. We've seen proposals to give teachers, nurses, doctors, firefighters, again, real terms pay cuts in the future. And these are people who are in, you know, these are people with skills. These are people that we desperately need in this country. These are people who have options and can leave and can be paid far more if they move to Australia. Yet we're saying to them, not thank you for your service, not thank you for helping look after us, because these are the same people who we called heroes during COVID when we all desperately needed them. The government is essentially now saying, we're going to force you to pay for the tax cuts that we never properly financed at the beginning. And we're going to make sure that you face a reduced quality of life, a reduced purchasing power, right? Because we want to make sure there are the possibility of tax cuts in the future. That's not how I think we deliver the workforce that we need in the future. It's not how we make teaching and nursing attractive careers in the future. Instead, it's just simply trying to get some short-lived financial support out of something that's going to cost us all so much more in the long run.
A little over, about nearly 2 years ago, the Inland Revenue had a research team that showed that the wealthiest New Zealanders pay much less than half the tax rate of other Kiwis and much less than their peers in similar OECD countries. Isn't this crisis caused by neoliberal economic policies, where repeated succession of governments have been unwilling to go into debt to pay for physical infrastructure, unwilling to introduce more equitable taxes, such as a strong capital gains tax and corporate taxes, in order to raise the money to equitably pay for public services and infrastructure? Could you talk about this and what it means for public service workers like nurses, hospital cleaners, teachers, and teachers' aides?
Well, it's certainly been the case, Marvin, that over the past 40 years, we've built a financial and a government fiscal framework based upon the idea that if we kept taxes low, if we kept spending low, if we reined in the activities of government, then the private sector would flourish. And in delivering that flourishing private sector, there would then be jobs and incomes, and everybody would be better off. We've now tested this for 40 years and it hasn't worked. And not only has it not worked in New Zealand, it's not worked around the rest of the world. All it's simply led to is an impoverished public sector. It's led to reductions in public services. It's led to growing child poverty. It's led to, you know, higher unemployment, structurally higher unemployment, right? All so that a few people, some wealthy people, can do much better. And we've seen that in the wealth inequality data in New Zealand, where wealth inequality has expanded enormously over the past 40 years. So
you could say it's actually worked out very well for the people who introduced it.
Indeed. You know, and they and their defenders are doing incredibly well over the past, you know, we've seen, if you just take something as simple as house prices have exploded over the past 40 years. Home ownership has become increasingly difficult to achieve, particularly if you don't have wealthy parents to help back you up at the beginning. And shelter, a basic human right, has become a financial service. And this is, none of this benefits your average New Zealand worker. None of this benefits communities right up and down the country. Instead, we've seen a withdrawal of public services, a withdrawal of public expenditure, in the hope that if we try the recipe even harder in the future, this time it will work, right? You know, there's a phrase where I come from in the northeast of England that beatings will continue until morale improves. And that's essentially the approach that's been adopted over the past 40 years here. Now, we need to turn that around. We still have the chance to turn that around, but it means viewing the role of the Crown, viewing the role of the government differently. It means viewing what good looks like in the economy differently. And it means viewing how we achieve those ends very differently. And that does mean fairer taxation. It does mean higher levels of investment. It does mean a stronger role for the state. And importantly, it means focusing on high employment, low unemployment, high wage growth as being the key drivers of economic growth, not private wealth accrual.
Doesn't Treasury still support this orthodoxy, basically?
Treasury as an institution believes in, as I've said, this is a former Treasury official, in very tidy accounts. So if debt is low, if spending is low, then ministers have options in the future to help, you know, they can make better decisions if they have more space to make those decisions. The challenge is, of course, is what the Treasury calls space is just simply lower spending. What the Treasury calls low debt is simply less investment in the country. Now, you can overspend. You absolutely can. And you can overinvest. But in New Zealand, we're nowhere near any of those particular problems. Net debt on the IMF measure, so we use the IMF measure because it's internationally comparable. Net debt on the IMF measure in New Zealand is 23% of GDP. It's 30% in Australia. It's 95% in the UK. It's 98% in the US. And it's 133% in Japan. The reason why we don't have things, we don't have nice things in New Zealand, the reason why we don't have public transport systems, state housing, why we don't have, you know, the transport networks that we want, is because we haven't paid for them. We haven't invested in them. And if we want those things, we need to do that. That not only helps deliver a better economy, it helps grow jobs, and it actually helps all of us in the long run because we have the public services that we all rely upon.
Isn't this even more important now because of climate change?
It's absolutely more important because of climate change, because the risks to people's property, the risks to life, the risks to our economy in the future are growing. And the faster we make interventions, both to manage our emissions and to reduce our emissions, but also to grow a different kind of economy where growth isn't dependent upon growing our carbon emissions, then we will be more resilient to things like oil price change in the future. Oil prices have been one of the key drivers of inflation in New Zealand over the past 40 years. If we grow an economy where we see a more diverse range of industries, where those industries that do exist aren't so reliant upon carbon-based power systems like dairy, then we will see those industries staying longer here and having a reason to be here. And that's something that we really need to do.
Aren't we
very urgently in a
partially self-induced recession, almost a depression, for the last couple of years?
Well, certainly we were in New Zealand's steepest recession since 1991 in 2024. That was in part caused by a collapse in government spending, a collapse in government investment. Government investment fell at its fastest rate since 1991 in 2024. We're hoping for a recovery in 2025, but the date at which that recovery turns up keeps being pushed backwards. And the last set of GDP data that we have for June 2025 showed a 0.9% fall in GDP. At the same time, the Treasury was predicting that GDP should be growing by 0.7%. So we've got some way to go.
Can we actually believe that if we continue doing exactly what we're continuing, we'll have an automatic recovery for everybody?
Well, the last two words in that sentence are really important, Marvin, which is for everybody, because we will have a recovery. There will be growth at some point in time. But whether or not it's equally distributed, whether or not it's equitably distributed, is an entirely different matter. And it's perfectly plausible that we will see a return to growth. But that growth concentrates that growth in very few hands. And those people who've really suffered and struggled since COVID to start to see growth, to start to get over the cost of living crisis that we've had, they won't benefit from any growth that turns up.
The Labour Party in New Zealand in the 1930s came to power because they had enough moral courage and vision to actually challenge the direction of capitalism openly and provide plans for what they were going to do and then carry them out. It doesn't seem like the two major parties haven't really done this kind of challenge yet.
So the first Labour government that I made called Joseph Savage replaced a one-term, what was called Liberal Unity government at the time, led by a fella called George Forbes. And they were so unpopular at that particular point in time because they were doing all of the things that the National Party is doing now. They cut investment in the middle of the Great Depression. They stopped spending on social programs. Famously, their finance minister told, apocryphally, told the unemployed to go and eat grass rather than receive any benefit support. And that created this, that unpopularity created the space for that revolutionary first Labour government. It created the space for, in particular, the 1938 Social Security Act, which gave birth to the, universal healthcare benefits, a wide range of services. Now, in New Zealand, right now, the Labour Party is managing that space. And so it is putting out things that I think will make an enormous difference. People might criticise the capital gains tax that's out there, but in comparison to having no capital gains tax, it's an enormous step forward. We have a system for capital gains tax in New Zealand which does not work and leads actively to bad outcomes. And so we should have a comprehensive capital gains tax.
Will this be comprehensive?
It'll be a capital gains tax which is comprehensively levied on investment properties and on commercial properties. So I think it's really important that, we bring that in. Is it the end of tax reform? Absolutely not. There's lots more tax reform that's needed in New Zealand. And we should keep all our options open because there's no such thing, Marvin, as a perfect tax system. We need to evolve our tax system as our needs evolve and as the country evolves.
Do you think the Green Party will gain votes in the next election because they're actually calling for a much more full and radical tax reform than we've seen?
I honestly don't know, Marvin. I'm an economist for a living. I think one of the things, I tend to leave the political soothsaying to the professionals on the other side of that conversation. But They've certainly been far more radical in putting out their, you know, their spending plans and their borrowing plans. It remains to be seen whether or not.
But their taxation plans have also been more radical than.
Yes. And the question is, you can generate the money. That's not a problem. You can tax people more. You can create the spending. The question is whether or not we actually have the capacity to then deliver what's needed, because. Spending in government, generally speaking, if you want to make spending happen, you can. That's not the problem. The problem is, do you have the workforce? Do you have the materials? Do you have the ability to then translate that resource into real investment, real change across the country?
How was the first Labour government able to do what they did? I don't mean just the legislation, but they actually built the houses, state houses. They actually built up the railways, encouraged it.
So the state house building program that started to take place, because I live in the city here in Wellington, where we had the first state house in New Zealand, down in Miramar. It built that, one, the population was much smaller, but two, it built that through the Ministry of Works working with what ended up becoming Fletcher Buildings and having standardised designs and helping to deliver housing, that was fit for purpose, that managed to deliver a real increase in the quality of life for those people who were receiving that housing. And it did it essentially by borrowing. It did it essentially by investment. There's a choice here for New Zealand about how much investment it wants to see and how it wants to deliver that. The challenge on the other side, of course, is that right now we have a government that's actively disinvesting in things like housing, and that's the choice that's going to be in front of people at the next election, I think.
Don't we actually have to rebuild our ability to build?
Yes, and that's the conversation we had about the Ministry of Works, is that a big part of that will be, do we want to build a separate capacity to do that so that even if the market doesn't have capacity, the Crown has the capacity to build and has the capacity to build in ways that are different to the capacity that the market might want to provide?
If we're going to have independence and national sovereignty, don't we have to have that?
Personally, I would argue yes, because otherwise you're at the whims of the markets. And the markets aren't your friend.
Also,
markets will be your friend as long as you're being friendly to them.
And the biggest private sources of capital are from overseas.
And, our four largest banks are all Australian-owned.
Well, they used to be New Zealand-owned.
Yeah, and the key challenge for many of our own pools of capital, so, for example, around 80% of all of our KiwiSaver investments are actually held overseas. So they're not even being invested in New Zealand. If we went to Australia, around 50% of the Australian pension funds investments are actually made in Australia, which makes a really big difference to the amount of investment capital that exists in that country. And that's why the Future Investment Fund is so important. I heard Sam Stubbs yesterday talking about Kiwi Invest, which would see investment funds investing in New Zealand. I think these are both positive steps in terms of investing more in New Zealand and deepening the pools of capital and allowing us to deliver the things that we need.
We're talking with Craig Rennie, the economist and director of policy for the New Zealand Council of Trade Unions. For the life in New Zealand, it appears to me anyway, for the last 30 years have been getting more and more unequal and unfair. To continue this trade, does it not the government need to weaken unions and the collective power workers? And would you like to talk about the connection between weakening the unions and growing inequality?
Sure. Thanks, Marvin. One of the things we've seen in New Zealand since 1991, since the Employment Contracts Act, is that labour productivity, so the stuff we produce, so that the average output of a worker has gone up every year, and it keeps going up every year. But wages aren't going up at the same rate at which output is growing up. Now, the gap between those two things is essentially a profit to the employer. And so what we've seen every year is that profit to the employer grow and grow and grow. Now, when that happens once or twice, that's fine, you know, but for it to consistently happen over a period of time means that wealth inequality, income inequality, it grows and grows and grows over that period. Now, the reason I chose that year in particular is because, of course, 1991, the Employment Contracts Act saw the severe weakening of trade unions in this country. And we've seen consistent and repeated attacks by not only that 1991 government, by the Jim Bulger government, but by conservative governments ever since. And not since the latest sets of attacks, removing fair pay agreements, getting rid of 90-day trials, making it harder to access employees through what's called a 30-day rule for trade unions. All of these things have made it harder for unions to organise. All of those things have made it harder for people to get good terms and conditions in their work, and has led to growing insecurity at work. And as a consequence, lowering union density, making it harder for unions to operate, and more insecure workforces makes for higher inequality, and in particular, higher wealth inequality in New Zealand.
Okay, we can see that that's one of the results of the policy toward saying the free market is always the best. But also, haven't we seen something in a contradiction of this? Because we've seen private power increase, but we've also seen monopoly of power increase. I think a good example of that is actually the monopoly of generational electricity by investors.
Well, certainly in New Zealand, New Zealand generates the same amount of electricity that it generated 10 years ago. 44,000 gigawatt hours a year, right? But since that period of time, we all each use about 30% less electricity than about 10 years ago, right? Now, that's not because demand for electricity has gone down from individuals. We have more electric cars. We have more heat pumps. We have more electric cookers. We have more electric gadgets. Everything from, you know, robot hoovers to your iPad all work on electricity. Now, what's happened is essentially we've deindustrialized, and the big users of electricity in factories and in plants have stopped using it because it's become more expensive. Why has it become more expensive? Because we've taken larger and larger and larger dividends out of those firms rather than invest. And in fact, investment in the years leading up to partial privatisation in 2012, we saw investment every year be higher than profits. Every year since partial privatisation, profits have been higher than investment. So we're taking more and more out of those industries.
The generators actually make more money when there's a power shortage, don't they?
Correct. We operate a market on artificial scarcity. So the last unit of electricity in New Zealand sets the price for everyone. So we end up with a market where we say, okay, all the renewable energy can't quite fulfill the need. So we turn on the coal-fired power station at Huntly. That's the most expensive electricity in the country, and everyone benefits from that electricity price. But what it means is if we invested in new generation, that meant we didn't have to turn on the coal-fired power station, the price of electricity would fall for everyone. Now, the providers have got no interest in that because that's their profit.
Don't you have two situations in this? You have many households, particularly in the South Island, who really can't afford to keep their houses warm. And the upper middle class, they can provide panels and provide some of their own electricity. But ordinary Kiwis find that difficult. And so they're the people that have trouble heating their houses. And then you've got sawmills and other industries both in the South Island and the North Island, and many of the places where they've already lost freezing works during the first imposition of neoliberalism in New Zealand in the 90s. But now we're still losing industry. We're still losing the variety of industries we're losing, too. I mean, we want to be able to do something besides send over a dried milk powder to China. I mean, what kind of economic basis is that?
Well, you're right, Marvin. Essentially, the government's energy policy is a mess. You're right. If you're on a low income, you probably face very few choices in terms of, you know, your ability to generate new sources of electricity. You can't afford to pay for solar on your roof or a wind turbine or something else. And if you rent your home, it's a non-starter to begin with. You can't put these things on to begin with. Yeah. So it is the poorest who are paying the price in that space. Electricity prices went up 11.7% this year alone. Over the past 4 years, they've gone up around 30%.
What happens to workers in Okuni if their mill closes down?
Yep.
Because they can't afford the electricity to run the mill.
And we've seen that already in places like Tokoroa, where OG's closed its paper plant. That's going to lose 260 jobs. Also in the town, Coulterhout Harvey is closing its plywood plant. There's a further 120 jobs going there. We're seeing these job losses overall, and they will cascade into the real economy because these are well-paid, secure, unionized jobs. And when they go, the local cafes, the restaurants go, the local bars go, house prices fall because nobody wants to live there anymore because there's no work. And we need to do something more to stem that negative cycle that occurs when you see large job losses.
You mean redirect it, don't you?
Yeah. Well, one of the things that we see is what we saw in New Zealand over the 80s and the 90s, where you saw, you know, sawmills go and plants go, and nothing came in their place. And the only thing that replaced it was meth. And as a consequence, if we don't act now, we're guaranteeing that long-run problem in the future. All the economic evidence tells us the faster we intervene, the better that we make decisions, the more we deliver a just transition for workers, the better off these communities will be.
What should political parties be saying about what they're going to do about electricity? I mean, the present system is not working, except to enrich the dividend holders.
I think, you know, political parties should be absolutely clear about what it is that, you know, they should be seeking to do in the energy markets. What's the role of electricity in their industrial policy, for example? The CTU has called publicly and written a report, which you can access on the CTU's website, for publicly owned energy, where we bring all of the energy providers back into public ownership, so that we can make sure that we're delivering the energy needs that we need for the country, not the energy needs that we need for a profit. I'm very keen for political parties to think very long and hard about what is the role of the state in delivering electricity, particularly to deal with climate change, particularly to deal with our carbon emissions, but most importantly, to deal with the inevitable employment consequences if we continue on the track that we're going on, where we're going to keep shedding manufacturing and process jobs around the country because these industries simply can't afford to exist.
Well, frankly, don't we need to do the opposite? We need a variety of industries.
Yes, but one of the things we don't need to do is to shed the jobs as quickly as we might do and induce shocks in communities where we see cornerstone employers just go overnight.
What I'm saying
we
is, if we
manage that change much
if
better.
We get rid of industries, we're not diversifying. We're giving ourselves fewer choices.
Correct. And if we need to be making sure that we're supporting the industries that exist, helping them through that energy transition, but then encouraging growth in new sectors, so that we're less susceptible to changes in electricity and in other demands in the future.
Do you are the CTU's plans for how would they make the energy sector public again? What would that entail?
So essentially what we've said is that every year the Crown generates around $1 billion in profit from its shareholdings in the electricity companies and in the transmission networks. And we would use that dividend to start buying the shares back so that over time we would own all of the shares again. And the faster that those companies make profits, the faster they'll be back in public hands. Alternatively, if they use their profits to grow generation, to reduce costs for everyone, we all benefit.
What's happening now is that the benefits have gone entirely to the people who own the stocks. And how well, don't you think that actually a lot of New Zealanders, particularly New Zealanders who worry about paying their power bills, would welcome this kind of change if it were presented?
I certainly believe so. I certainly believe most New Zealanders think that they would like to see a better deal on electricity. We've got more than 100,000 households in New Zealand who live in energy poverty, meaning that they're spending more than 10% of their household income on energy costs. We're seeing, we're not seeing the bringing forward of new renewable energy projects. Instead, we're seeing the government investing further in oil and gas, putting money aside to co-invest in oil and gas, rather than tackling the problem really at its source, which is that how do we deliver energy security for the country?
One of the problems I see with the present system is that the governments have been reluctant to haul in on the control of the cost of electricity, because if you have a government that's got a neoliberal economic philosophy, whichever party it is, why, that means they don't have to increase taxes because they've got indirect tax. They tax ordinary people when they pay for the electricity. And they get a good share of those dividends.
Yep. And one of the things that we've been in the past, when the state owned more of these assets, we had the opportunity to get the dividends from those assets and use them to help pay for the public services that we needed and also to help grow the economy more widely.
Now it's paying for cutting taxes for the wealthy.
Well, we saw that at the first budget of this government, where the government cut income taxes by around $14 billion, and it paid for it mainly through borrowing, because we increased our borrowing by $12 billion to pay for it.
But it also meant even Labor governments could get away without increasing taxes too much because they were getting these dividends. So it's affected both governments.
Yeah, and one of the things that we need to do is think much harder about what we do with those dividends so we're getting the outcomes that we want rather than just the cash.
The problem with the dividends, of course, it points in a different direction.
Well, in the long run, one of the things I would love to see happen is that once generators are back in public ownership, we use the dividends from public ownership to help insulate homes around the country, to help make sure that we're using energy much more efficiently, to help make sure that New Zealanders are able to lead warm, comfortable lives in their houses, because as a country, we have structurally built our housing stock very inefficiently. We don't insulate our homes.
Would the CTU like to see a Department of Public Works and Planning so we could plan for a future in which we deal with climate change, we deal with mitigation of climates, and we deal with an economy to try to make fairer? Not only more productive, but fairer.
Absolutely. So one of the things the CTU has called for repeatedly in its Reimagining Aotearoa document is the recreation of a Ministry of Works, has called for a recreation of a much more capable and active state in helping to manage the economy and to make sure that we're getting the outcomes that we want out of the economy, not just more growth. More growth is great, but if that growth goes to fewer and fewer people, that doesn't mean we're all benefiting.
Also, more growth must be sustainable growth. And what we consider sustainable should be clearly looked at, because obviously the world is not living sustainably.
Not only are we not living sustainably, some of us are really struggling along the way. So how do we manage the delivery of a more equitable economy along the way?
Yeah. What are your hopes for the future then? I think you've just discussed some of them.
Well, my hopes for the future are essentially that we do, you know, we deliver on that program of change, that we see New Zealanders benefiting from government policies that help deliver them more secure work, help deliver them, you know, a greater, higher quality of life, more spending power, that they're not spending so much of their income on getting access to a house or on paying the rent, that, you know, we see fewer New Zealanders leave. We lose a New Zealand passport holder every 7 minutes and 11 seconds in this country right now, right? And these people who are not coming back, these are our grandkids and our children jetting off overseas for better opportunities in Australia. Those are the things I want to see in New Zealand. I actually don't think these things are actually very hard. We just need to make different choices.
Should we also be thinking about how we can build a more sustainable local economy? So if we do have difficulty with climate and transport, we can feed ourselves.
Well, both of these things go hand in hand. If I have the consequences of some climate change are sadly now inevitable. We're going to face stronger storms. We're going to face more adverse weather. We're going to face more challenging environmental conditions. So we need to be building better water infrastructure to deal with it. Marvin, you're in a city in South Dunedin faces real challenges because parts of it are below sea level. So how do we manage that change better? And how do we put the infrastructure in so that places like South Dunedin are viable places for people to live in the future? You know, there's a whole bunch of things we can do, but actually it's not a case of we do that or that. Doing these things actually leads to a better outcome, leads to a better economy, leads to better job security, and actually fundamentally benefits all of us in the long run.
Well, thanks a lot for coming on. I appreciate your vision and enthusiasm.
Thank you, Marvin.
You can podcast this by going to oarfmradio.org.nz and then going to podcast and going to Community or Chaos. Thanks a lot, Craig Rennie, for being on and for the work you're doing for the CTU.
Thanks, Marvin. Hopefully speak to you soon.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.